Hey there, opera fans. I'm Eric Teague. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm primarily a costume designer. You may have seen some of my work in different houses around the U.S., but, fun fact, I'm also a trans man. Ever wondered how alternative identities thrive in the opera world? As someone who makes art for his living, I wanted to explore that question the best way I knew how, by talking to some folks. On this show, I'll speak with other artists who exist under the rainbow umbrella, and talk about life, work, and what makes us shine the brightest. So now I'm wearing a new hat, as your host for Come As You Are, the podcast that goes beyond the curtain with our industry's amazing artists from the LGBTQ+ community and our allies. Think of this as a virtual coffee hour with some fascinating people whose work you've heard or seen in your favorite shows. Whether singers, directors, technicians, or designers, the thing that we share in common is that we all defy the gender expectations often associated with our industry. So grab yourself a cup and join us for a good story. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Come As You Are. I am your host, Eric Teague. I am a costume designer. My pronouns are he, him, his, and I am a trans man. And with us today is a really exciting artist. She's a lighting designer, and you have definitely seen her work before at the Atlanta Opera, Marcy Barbeau.
Hi, I'm Marcy. I use the pronouns she, her, hers, and I am a queer Chinese American lighting designer that loves opera. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, this is awesome. This is our maiden voyage, so it's just going to be a nice, fun little conversation between us. We're good friends and great collaborators, and we got to work together on the Three Penny Opera at Atlanta Opera last season, and struck up a good friendship, and I thought that Marcy's perspective would be really good for the podcast. As a lighting designer, a lady lighting designer, and a Chinese American lighting designer. So you've got some great.
What a trifecta.
I know, right? So if you wouldn't mind, just introduce our audience to you a little bit. Tell us about your journey.
Sure. Yeah. It's been a fun journey. I'll start off that way. I was adopted from China way back in the day when I was like 11 months old by this really wonderful woman, Caucasian woman in St. Louis, and she raised me by herself. She was an English teacher and a theater teacher. And then by the time I got to high school, she was doing the theater teaching full time. And she was the director for all our plays and musicals, which meant that I was doing all the plays and musicals because I was there all the time. I was like there. I remember specifically one show in high school. I think it was like Cinderella, and I'm the only person in the booth, and I was doing like the one spotlight cue and running the light board, but then running back to the sound booth or the sound console to like mute people when I needed to mute people for certain songs. It was.
What?
I felt so alive. It was kind of crazy. Yeah, it was so nuts. And then I would like make the programs for them, and sometimes I'd design the t-shirt. So it was like that was just kind of my huge involvement in theater. And then my senior year of high school, I really got involved with international thespians and state thespians. So we went to the state conference every year, and I ended up running for vice president. And then I also ended up doing the lighting design for this all state show that year that went to Lincoln for the International Thespian Festival that year.
Just casual.
Listen, when I think about that show that I did, I was like, I don't know what a magic sheet is. Like, I just want these lights to be green. It was just like, it was a whole thing.
Totally.
So that show, The Midsummer Night's Dream, is what we did. It was my first time using a jigsaw. It was like my first time really helping to build a set, which was really cool.
Wow.
And it was co-produced by Webster University in St. Louis. So we got to use the facilities at Webster, which are also, if you're not familiar with it, shared by the Repertory Theater St. Louis and Opera Theater St. Louis.
Cool.
So that's kind of where I first started in those facilities. And then I got into Webster. You know, I was like, okay, well, this is fun, and this is the only thing I can really see myself doing for like the rest of my life. So I should just do it. And so I just went to the conservatory at Webster, where I studied with Peter Sargent and John Wiley, and made some of my closest friends that I have now, and stayed in St. Louis, which is really great. And during that time, you know, I was able to work for Opera Theater St. Louis, which was not my first time with them. When I was like in third grade, I did like a summer camp with them and like played violin, and then we got to see the Magic Flute at the end of the week. So like that was like my first introduction to opera. So then working there, so working there in college was crazy and like super surreal. So yeah, that's a huge life story. And then I moved to Seattle after undergrad, worked there for a little bit, worked at Oregon Shakespeare for half a season as the lighting design fellow. And then moved to Boston for grad school, where we're both alums at BU.
Woo!
Always a good time at Boston University. Woo! Go
totally.
Terriers.
Terriers.
Is that our mascot at BU? I think it's Terrier.
Yeah, it's a Boston Terrier.
It's a Boston Terrier. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That absolutely makes sense. And there I studied with Mark Stanley, and you know, I really got to dive into my love of opera. The grandeur of it, you know, the music, the history of it. I just absolutely fell in love with opera, and I was like, this is really what I want to try to focus my career on, which is, you know, is hard. And obviously now I do a bunch of different stuff. As we all do as designers, trying to make our lives work. But opera is, you know, kind of really my main love and passion. And I've been really grateful to have these opportunities the past couple of years with the Atlanta Opera and now beyond. It's really, really exciting. So that's just a huge origin story for you.
Totally. That's your superhero story in a nutshell. But that's awesome. It sounds like you're basically doing theater from day one. Essentially,
yeah. Yeah. I have very, very fond memories of my mom taking me to see like my cousin and his high school production of Guys and Dolls, Seven Brides or Seven Brothers, something like that. And like going to the Muni when I was little in the summers. And my mom once my mom for a talent show, I think at our church, we sang a duet from Godspell together. Like it, like theater is the only thing that I've really. She raised me on theater, and luckily, you know, she's such a great supportive mother, and she was not one of those parents that was like, "You're gonna go into theater for like the rest of your life," and I was like, and she was like, "Yeah, well, of course you are. That's like all I've taught you."
That's
like
incredible.
What else are you gonna do? So
that's like a unicorn experience.
It really is. And she,
you know, like so many people here. Go ahead.
She was just a single mother high school teacher, you know, just making it work for us. And like, you know, that's why I think sometimes 10 out of 12s and these long tech weeks are never really that difficult for me, because I'm so used to it from a young age, because it was always either like being at school with my mom in her room, like doing my own homework while she was doing stuff for whatever after school program she was doing, or like me being at my grandparents, because my mom, you know, she still kept up with her theater life. So she like made sure she still had subscriptions to the Fox and the Repertory Theater St. Louis. So she would go see shows with her friends all the time. And then I'd be at my grandparents. So like, because that was just so important to her. And I think that really instilled a huge passion of theater for me.
So yay, mom. We can absolutely give a shout out to mom. Yes, amazing. Check plus gold star. That's
yay,
incredible.
Mom.
And and so when you got
I'm
to be
very
you,
lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And man, we should have your mom on the podcast. That would be awesome too, to talk about supporting art from young ages. Once you grew up a little bit more and you got into grad school and discovered this love of opera, was there a moment where you were like, oh yeah, I can really dig my heels into this and I want to make this my thing? Did you have a piece or a class or something that really was the illuminating moment for you?
At BU, one of our big projects, I believe our second year, is doing Flying Dutchman, Wagner's Flying Dutchman, obviously, and doing a plot for that. No, that was my first year, actually. And the size of them, and listen, Mark Stanley, if you're listening, I apologize. I did not do great on that project. We all know this. But having to like wrap my mind over these different sets, the different orientations for each act, and then what it meant just to, we had this project when, before we even started the plot, where we just have to light the overture. And just, I love doing like those kind of like light lab projects where you just have music and then you like, you get a cue to whatever you want.
Totally.
So doing that overture, I was like, this is badass. This is exactly what I do. And I, you know, I was able to assist a few times at Boston Lyric Opera, which was wonderful. But, you know, the real joy, my third year at BU, we have an internship semester, as you know. And I got to do my internship in Europe because of the amazing connections that Mark Stanley has. And I was able to assist Lucy Carter, this English lighting designer at the English National Opera for this new production of Salome that was all female design and directing team. The scenic slash costume designer and the director were both from Australia. It was this bonkers Salome. It was so beautiful, but so nuts. And I was like, this is what I want to do. I love that opera, very much like Shakespeare, can be put in so many different time periods and different settings and have so many different translations that you can just do so much with it. And, you know, it was my first time experiencing opera in Europe. And opera in Europe, I think, is, I've got a lot of opinions, but I love it. I think they take a lot of incredible risks. I don't know if you saw that La Boheme in Space that Paris Opera did.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. Fearless.
Yeah.
It got booed opening night, that La Boheme. But let me tell you, like, those pictures are gorgeous. I would have paid money to see that La Boheme in Space.
They did,
you know,
a thing.
I think they did a thing. Man, I wish I could have seen that. The, I think theater makers and young designers and, you know, not even young artists, people who are going to see our shows of our generation are kind of looking to see something exciting and new. You know, we have wonderful platforms now where we can stream all of this opera, and stream theater. So we can see those really great takes on these pieces. But I would love to see more of that kind of European style where we're taking risks, we're being fearless. And that Salome to me, you know, there's this giant hanging pink headless pony, like giant. The biggest thing I've ever stood next to that had like that cut off the head had rhinestones on it, because it was supposed to be like kind of representative of this toy that Salome had when she was a kid, and kind of shows like this kind of trauma that she grew up with growing up in that castle and that kingdom. And I was just like, this is crazy. And that was really, I was like, man, you can do anything with opera.
You totally can. And that's why I'm also really, really in love with the medium. I mean, the canon, the Western canon of music is incredible. Like, the first time I heard anything from the Grand Opera classics as a kid, I was blown away. And just the grandeur of it and just how big everything was and how the music made me feel something incredible. And I'm totally with you. To bring something visual that's really impactful is crucial. And whether we get to do crazy things
or
we have to do a very like naturalistic chamber opera, you're still telling a story, and that's awesome. I get excited about it. I mean, I think that's
it's
why
it's so exciting. What was your first opera, Eric?
Oh my god, like first I heard or first that I worked on?
Both.
okay, the first one that I heard was Gounod's Faust, and it's still one of my favorites. And I have not yet had the pleasure of designing it, but one day I'll get to do my Mephistopheles. And
if you're listening to this pod,
that's right.
Podcast, you got two great designers who want to design Faust. Let's go.
Totally. I've got a whole book of designs ready to go. Anyway, so that was the first one that I heard that really snagged me. But the first one that anybody let me work on, as a designer was Therese Racan at BU.
Oh, that's right.
So we both have BU opera excitement stories. And Therese has a great place in my heart because of that experience. And it was great. It was everything that my little goth kid heart could ever want. It was beautiful and it was jarring and weird. So how about you? What was your first one that you heard and first one that you designed that really meant something?
My first that I heard / saw was Magic Flute for Opera Theater St. Louis when I was a little kid. They did this. Yep. I don't know if they still do it. Yeah, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to do this like little kids camp in the summer. And like you just got to learn some pieces of music if you played an instrument. Like I got nominated by like my music teacher or something because I played violin. Nice. Like a really cool fourth grader. And Yeah, right. It was really cute. And then at the end of the week, you get to see the Magic Flute. And to be honest, now knowing what I know now, there's no way that I sat through a whole Magic Flute. Absolutely. At like fourth grade. That sounds insane. Sure. It's so long. So, but I'm sure I remember it being very magical and amazing and really enjoying it. And then I think the first opera I worked on, designed, might have been Pelléas and Melisande with Ilorin Meeker at BU.
Hey, I love Ilorin Meeker.
I had this, yeah, another BU alum, actually. This is now a podcast about Boston University.
That's right. This cannot be an ad for BU. But I was just going to say that it was another great early exposure to what opera can be and doing things like those small chamber operas. Because a lot of those early yeah. semester things were smaller pieces with a bigger thing in
the Fringe Festival
later
ones. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. So you had mentioned.
Yeah, that's what it was.
You had mentioned assisting on that English National Opera Salome and that it had a female led team. Could you speak a little bit more about your experience as a female lighting designer? Like, it's for folks that don't know, this is a really male and male energy dominated field, but there's a ton of amazing female lighting designers out there of every different flavor, like queer, straight, whatever, mm-hmm. anything under the sun, and wildly talented people. So can you speak a little bit about your experience? Has it been tough? Has it been hard to get in the door?
Well, to answer your first question, watching three women collaborate on such a big undertaking like the ENO is, was, I wouldn't trade that experience for the world. It was fabulous. They were all just so smart and so talented and so passionate about this story and what they wanted to do with it and this vision. I really enjoyed just being at the table with them. And honestly, you know, being around women, when you never realize how, that's not true. Sometimes it's hard to realize how many men you've been surrounded by for so long until you're finally in a room with like only women. And it is so relieving. It's Damn very, it. Very relieving. And it was just, I felt supported. I could see them all supporting each other, you know, despite, you know, every hiccup that could possibly happen in that show happened. I look up to Lucy Carter so much for doing this. I think it was might have been her first show at ENO, and doing the show and having it look so as fabulous as it did. It was beautiful. It was such a good time to watch. And then to answer your second question, it's hard being around men all the time. Can I say that? I think I can say that.
You can say that. I mean, that's your experience. So tell us what's going on.
You know, I've played a lot of different roles in the industry. You know, most recently was lighting supervisor at the opera. And, you know, now I got this great new role to be an associate. And, you know, I work at a bunch of different companies. And, you know, you're always, as a BIPOC female, you're always kind of fighting for your voice to be heard almost at every single turn. Like, there's sometimes, you know, when I'm leading a crew sometimes, and, you know, this happened, you know, even right after college as well, like, which is why so many people end up just hanging their own shows. I mean, there's small shows that can't afford electricians, but sometimes it's just easier because, you know, sometimes having being able to be that leader, but also not being seen as like not a collaborator or like not being seen as a bitch because I got firm and said, no, this is the way that I want you to do it.
Sure.
That has always been really, really difficult to navigate because I constantly have anxiety that I am going to be seen as a bitch, or I'm going to be seen as like this crazy woman who's just like upending people's ideas and like not letting them speak, which is, in my opinion, obviously not true.
Totally not true.
And it also comes down to like what we wear. Like I've spent a lot of time in my life figuring out my own personal style, and when I first came to Webster as like a young person, you know, I was immediately told that I had too much cleavage, like immediately, and how that would like stop me from getting jobs, and like how the way that I dressed was like because of the certain body type that I have, like it will stop me from having jobs, so I always had to cover up. And that was something that I did that. I was told that by mentors, and I was like, okay, like I'm a distraction, sure.
Oh no.
That's fine.
No, that's awful. Those same mentors were probably not saying the same things to their male students, you know, like commenting on their bodies and their presentation. So the double standard in our industry is across the board in a bunch of different pockets. And that's a really rough thing to deal with, especially when you're just there to make art. Like, that's what you're doing. You want to get a job and you want to make some art.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that you had to deal with that.
Oh, thank you. No, I appreciate that. I think it, you know, made me who I am today. You know, I didn't, it's hard. And, you know, especially being an assistant sometimes, I think there's a very fine line that you walk that I fell off multiple times of, like, what is considered professional and what is considered, like, you a female assistant being like overbearing or like not overstepping, whereas like I could see tons of male assistants speaking to their designers in a terrible way,
sure.
or like speaking to the electricians in a terrible way, and they're gonna keep getting hired, whereas like I had that one moment where I was like you know trying to keep everything kind of organized and together, and then that was it. You know, and that ends your relationship with a designer quickly. And I'm sure if any designers out there are listening, I'm so sorry. But but I have gotten to the point now where I am the older that I get, I'm getting better at recognizing those tendencies, but then also not apologizing when I know what I'm doing now. I feel, you know, imposter syndrome is huge, especially when you're a female BIPOC queer woman. Mm. Well, and for anybody in our industry, I think everybody knows what imposter syndrome feels like, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
And I'm finally getting to that point where I'm feeling a little bit more confident in my skills and that, no, I do know how this works. Let me move forward with it. This is what you hired me to do. And now I feel more confident in that. And I do think that that's starting to be seen. I, you know, was just talking to someone earlier that I feel like it's a really good time to be a young designer right now. Even with the pandemic and stuff, which is a whole other hour long conversation.
Sure.
We can get into,
sure,
right?
Sure.
But there's so many people stressing and realizing how non-diverse their design and creative teams have been, where it comes to race, where it comes to LGBTQ+, like everyone is realizing how non-diverse it was and how much it actually has affected their shows and the storytelling that they're presenting to their audiences.
Yeah.
And I think that right now is a really exciting time to be that like young, queer, BIPOC, female, whatever intersectionality you are, designer, because you're finally, we're starting to slowly, obviously there still needs to be more work done by a lot of people, but we're finally slowly getting to that point where we're getting that space in the room that we can talk about our experiences and then use that to help tell the story and push it forward and collaborate with all these other people that we get to know now. And it's so, so exciting.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I've always felt that the work is inherently better with a bunch of different voices in the room and a bunch of different experiences that are brought to the table. And I completely understand the, even though I don't have the same intersectionalities in my life, I do deeply understand that need to have some authority in your work and have people listen to you and acknowledge that you're saying the right thing and that you can be a friendly, jovial person, but also get the job done.
Yeah.
And be respected.
Yeah.
So that's something that I see you with that, because it's every time I walk into a costume shop, it's a challenge within myself to make sure that I'm presenting myself the best way to get the job done.
I have always really struggled with my Asian-ness and how I was raised very American and, to be honest, quite white. I was raised in the Midwest.
Sure.
I have no accent. You know, I try to like cook as much Asian food as I can, you know, and yet again, props to my mom. She's a very adventurous eater. You know, she was always like, let's celebrate Chinese New Year. You know, let's make this Chinese food. You know, she very much wanted me to be an Asian person. But, you know, when you're young, you want to be like everyone else. So I was like, I don't want to take Mandarin classes, mom. Like, I don't want to be, I'll play violin. Like, maybe that's it. Like, I was also the kid that like made their own Asian jokes because they were very funny at the time. And I just never really felt Asian. And it's been really interesting the past, I would say 3 or 4 years is when I'm really starting to make sure that like I am Asian. I am Chinese American. I may not have been raised in the most traditional Chinese sense. But my mom was very much a tiger mom. She's very hard on me. I'm just now kind of getting into that. And it's very, you know, I've had a lot of Asian people, and I swear to God, many Asian people have told me how not Asian I am. None in theater, just like, you know, random Asian people just coming up to tell me how I'm not very Asian.
Also,
which is a huge bummer.
How are you? Thanks. I guess. Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's been so interesting, and so I think that's part of the reason why I turned to theater and opera, and especially right now I'm way more vocal about diversity hires, and but also cultural appropriateness of opera. I think we could talk for hours about opera and how hard that is to navigate.
Because a lot
Butterfly, Turnabout,
exactly. There's so much in the canon that was created in the 19th century with a 19th century mindset of race and orientalism and just things that made people other, and using people's otherness as a design idea or a framework for a piece because it was exotic. And I'm fascinated with how great music can transcend that kind of history.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset of, I mean, I don't think these operas should be retired by any means. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are like, you should not be doing Butterfly ever again, or you should never do a Turnabout. And like, I just think that seems a little extreme, right? Yeah. Like, if you have the collaborators in the room who want to do the work and dig into that story and dig into that design process and really look at that history and what does that mean for us and then for the people we're showing this story to, I think there's, I mean, definitely compromises, but I think they have to be significant. I think people have to have those discussions and like not just skim over and be like, well, we know it's a little problematic, but we're still going to do this part. Like, no, it needs to be talked about. And I'm really excited to to be having those conversations with fellow artists lately. I've had a lot of people talk to me about that kind of stuff. And I still have, granted, more research to do, I think.
Sure.
When it comes to my own point of view on it. And also, honestly, there's like so many pieces that really should be talked about.
Yeah,
but
agreed.
Yeah, I just think it's really, really interesting.
Because everybody's life experience is all connected, even the stuff that we just listen to for fun impacts what we do at work, I think, because we're artists and we're always absorbing things like little sponges everywhere. So my sign-off question is this. What music do you love aside from classical? Or if you are just all classical all the time, what is your favorite composer?
No, not all classical all the time, which I know a couple of lighting designers would be sad about because they believe that you should be drafting while listening to classical music, which I totally get, but I can't because I need to be hyped up. And right now I am super, I need to get hyped. I need like some rap. I need to be pumped up to draft a plot. And right now, to be honest, I am listening to a lot. If you watch the show Insecure on HBO that Issa Rae created, that entire soundtrack for that show is just everything, my entire 2022 already. Like, that is the only thing I've been listening to, specifically like TMR. She's amazing. I truly have just, because of like all the stuff that I've been watching in the pandemic, which is still happening, I get a lot of my music from like TV shows and stuff, because I think watching TV shows and movies is really, really important for our work, to be honest. Also because I love it.
Totally. I absolutely agree, because we don't make things in a vacuum, because our audience is absolutely watching television and consuming media of all kinds. So yeah, I mean, we got to stay relevant.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's awesome. That's totally great. This has been a killer conversation. I've had a ton of fun, and I hope that you have too. And thank you so much for being on my show.
Yay! Oh my goodness, I had so much fun. Thank you so much. I'm so proud of myself for not cursing as much as I thought I would. So, woo!
Yay! Not a single one. Good job.
Yeah! Thank you so much for having me, Eric.
Now, if you had asked me 5 years ago about if my career would suffer from me being vocal about my trans identity, I would have said, hell yes! Because I couldn't conceive of a world where that would have been okay. But, as it turns out, my work did not evaporate. That feels like massive progress. And now, I have a podcast that lets me explore that progress for myself and other people in opera and beyond. And that also feels like massive progress. If you want to check out what Marcy's up to, you can check back in with the Atlanta Opera in the spring with the Come As You Are Big Tent program, which features her work in Cabaret and As One. Both great shows, and I'm really excited to work on them with her. You can also check out her work at her website, barbeaudesign.com. That's BARBEAUdesign.com. If y'all want to see what I'm up to, you can see plenty of my work at ericteaguedesign.com and on Instagram and Etsy at Opergeist, spelled OPERGEIST. Huge thanks to the Atlanta Opera for creating this podcast and the opportunities for these continuing conversations. And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us on this little journey. I'm your host, Eric Teague, and I hope to see you again. Bye, y'all.